Hey everyone, thanks for listening to my podcasts here on the Hullerstubber feed. Do spread the word to other people if you think they might enjoy them. Do listen to some more if you think you might enjoy them, but do enjoy this one. I am shortly going to be on tour with my new stand-up show, Can I Have My Ball Back? Head to richardherring.com/ballback/tour for all those dates. Some of them are sold out, some of them have hardly sold anything. It would really help me if you bought tickets to the ones that aren't sold out. Either way, as soon as you can. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. It's about cancer and testicles. One of them's not funny, but one of them's really funny, and it kind of cancels out the unfunniness. I'd say just on average, slightly more funny. So I hope you'll come along. If not, keep enjoying the podcast. We'll be back in September at the Leicester Square Theatre with more live podcasts. Maybe a few Edinburgh ones before then. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this stupid podcast you've chosen to listen to.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome to another Rahalastapa Book Club. This week we are looking at the fantastic book You Are Not Alone by Cariad Lloyd. Hello Cariad, how are you doing?
Hello Richard, I am exhausted, but it's very
are
nice
you?
To see your face. Yeah, I am actually.
Just from childcare or overwork?
Bit of childcare, bit of overwork, bit of burnout, bit of all of those things together. Bit of like post-PTSD, post-pandemic stress disorder. But apart from that, I'm fine, you know.
Okay, good. Yeah, I've been quite tired. And then just this week, I seem to have rallied a bit. I don't know why.
But I haven't been
working much. So that might be the key.
That might be it. I need a fucking break. But yeah, apart from that, I'm fine. Very excited to be here. Thank you for choosing my book for your book club.
No, I loved it. I listened to it on Audiobooks book a couple of weeks ago. And tell us a story of it. Obviously, it comes out of your fantastic podcast, Griefcast. So it's nice to see a book that has emerged from a podcast.
Tell us
a little bit, for anyone who doesn't know, tell us a bit about Griefcast and how the book came about.
Well, I will. I want to say very quickly, in case anyone listens to the audiobook, there is a problem with the original audio files, and it sounds like I'm doing a child's voice at one point. And I keep getting messages from people going, wow, why did you do that and how? That is, you should re-download it. If you've downloaded the audiobook and it sounds weird, that's not my theatrical decision to play myself as a child. Anyway, my dad died in 1998 when I was 15. So I joined the club early, as I like to say on the show, and I'd been talking about grief for like quite a long time, but not publicly, like never in my work at all. Like it was always very like hushed, you know, you might find someone at a party and they might say, oh, sorry, I'm a bit weird. Like, you know, my mum just passed away. And I'd be like, oh my God, let's talk about it. Oh my God, someone else in the club. Like I was like desperate for people to talk about it. Sure. And in 2016, as I'm sure you'll remember, it was the birth of podcasts when podcasts were only comedians. Like they were the only people bothering to buy mics and do this stupid thing. Yeah. And all my friends that week had like announced, I'm doing a podcast. And I was walking along the road and I thought, if I had a podcast, what could I do? I'd probably just talk to people about death. And then I thought, well, that's a terrible idea. That's awful. That will never, ever happen. Who would listen to it? And it was just one of those ideas that just, you know, it just keeps, you keep thinking about it, keeps knocking on your door, keeps going, why don't you just do that? And I was pregnant with my first child. And so I wasn't really working. And I thought, oh, maybe I'll just record a few and see if it works. And then obviously I decided to interview comedians because that's the people I had in my phone book. When I say phone book, Gen Z, I mean the numbers on my phone, saved in my phone. And I recorded four, and the luck is that my daughter was 2 weeks late. That's what happened. And so in that 2 weeks, I learned to edit and put them up on SoundCloud, and then, you know, had a baby. Thought, well, yeah, that's good. The idea's done. Yeah. And then I just started getting loads of emails, and I was like, oh, the idea isn't done, is it? Because other people feel like you do, and other people want to talk about it. But I didn't know until I put the first four out, which was, you know, Sarah Pascoe, Adam Buxton, Jade Adams, and comedy producer John Harvey. So that's what the first four was, just very, you know, people I knew, really, who talked about their grief publicly. That's why I kind of spoke to them.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it's one of those subjects, I mean, that as comedians, we sort of do like as well a little bit, because it's something that people don't talk about, but it's something that people should absolutely talk about, and that talking about it really helps. And that's why the podcast is such a success, because people want to hear other people's experiences to know that they're not alone, which is the great title of the book.
That's what I went for.
And you know, but it's just that reassurance, but also that as you discovered straight away that people were contacting you to talk to you about, you know, to tell you their stories as well. So it's
yeah, definitely. And I just sort of thought I was a bit odd, and I was sort of, you know, I wanted to talk about it, but no one else really did. And also, that was my big thing. That's why, I mean, obviously I knew comedians, but the big thing was I knew that if I spoke to comedians, they'd make jokes and that it wouldn't be depressing, because I couldn't think of anything worse than like listening to a podcast about death for an hour and then feeling like, you know, pressing stop on your phone and being like, oh, I feel worse. Like, I was like, no, I want you to at least after an hour think, well, you know, I do still feel shit, but I did laugh, and at least that person has also been through it, so that you'd feel like 5% better. You'd be like, oh, I guess, yeah, I'm not the only one. And that really helped me when I found other people who'd been through similar situations. I found it really like, oh, okay, yeah, this is just something that happens. And, you know, obviously not to everybody, and that as in not everyone loses a parent that young, but I found other people who had, or lost even younger. And that made me think, oh, okay, there's actually quite a lot of us who have been through this, but no one, you know, you obviously when you meet someone, you don't always know their trauma. But now, thanks to the times we are living in, you do. Thanks, times.
But it's good, you know, and it is something, obviously, that the situation is more difficult for some people than other people, I think, for you. So, this isn't in no way a comedy book. There are some funny things in the book, it's a serious book, and it's very much, I would say, for people who are grieving, right? Who are struggling with grief. That's the sort of the intended. Or are hit by grief. They're not necessarily struggling with it, but, you know, are trying to cope with how they feel and how they should feel and how they're made to feel. I'm not going through grief at the moment. In fact, you do talk about somebody in the book who goes to you, oh, you know, you'll get over it though, because it's not that bad. And who then discovers he's never had any real unexpected thing. I suppose it's the unexpected thing, which, you know, there are elements where that's happened to me. I might talk to you later about, weirdly, I think, like, when I was ill a couple of years ago, you know, I sort of had grief for myself in the moment discovered that I probably had cancer, but also from the other side, from my own kids, I was sort of worried about what would happen to my kids if, you know, if I was to go sort of imminently. So I kind of, you know, I do understand it. But I think this book will be very helpful for anyone who is feeling alone and feeling that there's nowhere to turn, because it's about, you know, you don't ever let go of that grief, and you're not, you know, people encourage you to get over it, and that's not the answer, is it?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, you know, I have a chapter in it called What to Say and What Not to Say. So that was obviously aimed at people who, as we say, aren't in the club. Or I also like to say, like, maybe you haven't had capital G grief, you know, like you might have known people, but it hasn't like massively hit you, like, oh, that's sad, rather than like, oh my God, my world has imploded. I wanted it to be, I sort of use the phrase sometimes like a roadmap, in the way that a map doesn't tell you where to go. It just shows you what the land looks like. So that's what I'm trying to show you. Like, this is what grief looks like. It can be a bit rough, but like we all did make it through to the like next level. Massively the biggest thing I felt was, after doing nearly 200 episodes, like 7 years of interviews, everybody I spoke to would say to me, like, oh, I didn't do that very well, or I don't think I did that right. And I suddenly clocked about, you know, halfway through my years of podcasting and thinking, well, then none of us did this right. Like, nobody, there isn't a right way to do, but we're all convinced, oh, someone else is doing this better than I am. Like, I'm just making it up as I go along. And actually, grief is a completely unique process, and no one can tell you what's right for you. And there's lots of things we have in common, you know, that, like, that we can all meet each other and that sort of point on the road. But, you know, your road is your road. And the idea I really wanted to get across is, yeah, you don't get over it. You don't get over it. And that doesn't mean every day is like a nightmare and you're weeping. And I always stress to people, like, I don't have a picture of my dad up surrounded by candles that I like pray to every night. Like, that's not what you're dealing with. You're dealing with someone who, you know, if you say to me, are you still sad that happened? I would say, yeah, I'm still sad that kind of happened, because he was my dad. But, and are you still, someone asked me the other day, like, well, are you still grieving? And I was like, well, why do we want people to either be in it or out of it? It's like, it's just something I live with. It's, you know, the same way that I have mild asthma if it gets too cold. You know, it's just like something I live with. It doesn't always bother me, but at times it does. And at times I need to, like, allow it to bother me.
And the book is, you know, as well as being, because it comes out of the podcast, so there's some excerpt and the audio, but there's some literal excerpts from the podcast. But it is a lot of it is your story and your story with your dad, which is very moving. But equally, it's sort of very honest in terms of, you know, not turning him into like a figure of like saintly figure of,
oh, God,
this
no.
man
I
was
mean,
amazing.
I couldn't. But equally,
But equally not, you know, being honest enough to admit that, you know, things fade, or you remember someone from a certain point. Well, you remember your dad when he was very ill. It took you a while to kind of get memories of him when he wasn't very ill, which, you know, is very, very sad. So it's, you know, and I guess also 15, losing a parent at 15 is possible. I mean, I thought about this a lot because with my kids, I was thinking, you know, would it be better if I die now before they will remember me, or would it be better if I, you know, so like
you don't get any, you know, it's pros and cons to everything. I'm always saying that, like, I get to think, you know, with my dad dying at that age, I didn't get to finish the conversation. That's the big thing with being a teenager. You're like halfway through, still treating them as a child, you know, you as the child, and you're kind of becoming an adult and you're starting to see them as an adult, but not really at 15. You still think like they're basically a twat. I'm like, what are they asking you to do? Like, why are they there? And well, I was. And you don't get to sort of then look at them and be like, oh, I see, you're just doing your best and it was hard and, you know, you were tired. you were running a business from the study in the house. Like, yeah, that must have been stressful. So you don't get to see that. But equally, yeah, you don't get to, you know, I often think, because we had such a cantankerous relationship, I often think, well, in one way, we haven't had a lot of the arguments that I know we would have had. So, like, it's not that I'm glad he died at all, but it's just there's always another sort of way of reframing it or looking at it and being like, yeah, he's frozen in that world. And that, yeah, it is painful. And I suppose, you know, obviously, I have a background in comedy, but I wanted the book to be honest. And I knew from my own experience of grieving that you have to say to people like how bad it can be, because it can be. And if you try and deny it and be like, oh, it's all right, you'll be all right, you'll get over it, you know, then two months into it, they're like, what the fuck? This is fucking awful. Why did no one tell me? So I wanted to really put in some of that painful stuff to be like, yeah, look, this was so painful, but yet I am here and I'm all right, even with those memories. Like, I found a way to deal with even that. I think it's important people see that, you know, it's many things. It's not, oh, it's the worst, you know, he died, therefore I'm a complete mess up, fuck up. Or like, he died, therefore everything's wonderful because I appreciate life and I appreciate the smells every day. Like, you know, you don't. It's more complicated than that.
Of course, yeah. And, you know, and what's interesting, I think, again, and I think I would still recommend it to people who aren't grieving, because I think it's still like a really important book to read, because you should
recommend to everyone, guys. Whoever's got an Amazon account or likes buying books from independent bookstores, it's for everyone.
You should think about death. But, you know, I think like grief is an interesting thing because we're supposed, you know, you're supposed to feel it's private. It's almost a shameful thing. And you talk about how this all, you know, how that sort of feeling began. But it's sort of so weird, you know, for someone who's grieving to feel, oh, I better not talk about this because it'll bore people or annoy people. And people who aren't grieving, you know, so it's sort of like the sad version of becoming a parent, isn't it? No one wants you to talk about your kids.
Yeah, no one wants.
And no one wants you to talk about your dead relatives or whoever it might be. So, or you feel that, and yeah, that is, it's such a weird thing, because obviously, you know, that's what's lovely about this podcast and about the, you know, that it has become various clubs and a place for people to meet to talk about it, because it's, you know, because absolutely we should be talking about this stuff, and the idea of grief being private is, and you know, and something to hide away. I mean, is that from the sort of Victorian times? Is that you do discuss that?
I don't. It's so strange, isn't it? Like, because the thing I always find mind-boggling, it's like, it's not like I'm special. Like, it's going to happen to everybody, every single person. Like, not everybody has kids. Not everybody, like, buys a house or goes to university. Like, but the universe experience we'll all have is being born and dying. So it's kind of weird that we don't talk about it, because it's definitely going to happen. But I think there's this mutual thing where the people who are grieving feel like they can't bring it up, because like somehow it's boring, or like you're bumming everyone out with your depressing death stories. So they got this sense of like, oh, no one really wants to hear it. And the people listening to them are like, oh, I can't ask them. I don't want to upset them. So yeah. I don't want to make it worse. I don't want to upset them. So then you get this mutual like politeness, which means nobody discusses anything, which like they desperately want to talk about. Yeah. And as I say in the book, like if you, the reason Griefcast works and is a successful podcast is, you know, on that show, I'm letting people turn up in a studio for an hour or be on Zoom. And I'm saying, give me the name of your person, talk about them for an hour. And that just doesn't happen in any other, you know, sphere of our world. Like every other sphere is like, oh, I better change the subject, or, you know, I don't want to, oh, I'm getting upset. And just to give someone a space and be like, for an hour, I'm just going to ask you about them and how you felt about them and what they were like. And I'm not going to go, anyway, oh dear, oh, a bit depressing. Oh, you know, well, why don't we have a cup of tea? Like, I'm just going to sit with you in that. And what I've learned from doing that is that it's fine. Like, it's actually fine. We all have such a fear. And I definitely did as well. Like, oh God, what if it's really depressing? Or I don't want to be there. And actually just give someone enough time to talk about it till they're done. And they're like, yeah, I'm done now talking about them. No one, you know, you naturally feel like the need to change the emotional status. You don't sort of sit wailing for 3 hours. That's not how most people work. And so I think it's just this thing of like, people do want to talk about it. They really do. They want to talk about their person. They want to remember them because it feels like they didn't exist because no one's talking about them. And yet people aren't asking because they think, oh, look, I don't want to upset them. But actually, it's more upsetting to not talk about the person, to not be asked, to act like nothing's happened. And, you know, this is the thing, grief is unique. No one can really understand your grief, but every grieving person I've spoken to has said, it's really annoying when no one asks me. It's really upsetting when people change the subject, or they cross the road even because they like, don't want to, they know something awful's happened to me and like, you know, they just don't bring it up. So I wish we would just allow people to be sad and not be so panicked when it happens. You know, if somebody starts crying when you say to them, oh, I'm so sorry about your dad, and they well up a bit and they're like, oh, thanks. You know, that doesn't mean you made them cry. You've upset them. The death made them cry. The dead dad is making them cry. You're just allowing them to express something and giving them space to be like, yes, you can be sad for 2 minutes. I'm going to be here for you. And I think that's the thing of like, I say in the book, like, you can't re-dead the dead. Like, that's happened. So you asking is not going to make it worse. You can be awkward or crass or say something insensitive that might, you know, be painful, but you can't really make it worse. Like, the bad thing has happened. So once you sort of let yourself off the hook a bit and kind of go, oh, fuck it, I'm just going to ask them. And if they get really upset, I can always say, oh God, sorry, this is too upsetting. We can change the subject, but I just wanted you to know that I care. I just wanted to try and be here for you. I'm sorry if I've done it badly. Like,
it's a really good point. And, you know, and reading the book, I kind of, you know, I realize, I think because there's no real way of knowing what the polite thing to do. And I do, you know, you make some very good points in the book, but I, you know, I met a friend who I hadn't seen for a couple of years, maybe probably since before lockdown, and his brother had died during lockdown. And, you know, I didn't say anything about it. And then somebody else mentioned it. And then there was all this like, oh, you know, I didn't know whether to say anything or everything. And of course, he wanted it to be acknowledged. So it's much better to acknowledge it. And I've read a couple of books about death. I think this is from yours just in the last week. So if I get confused,
I'll take it. Anything you say is mine.
But someone says, oh, that's a bit fucking shit, isn't it? It's just like, just being able to say that is enough,
shit,
you know,
because that's
really fucking a terrible and shitty thing to happen. Because it's difficult to know what to say. Because I did a show about death and, you know, people saying, oh, I'm sorry, is a weird thing to say because it's not their fault, as you say. So it's really different, but it's really, we don't have the vocabulary to do it. So I think, oh, that's really fucking shitty. You know, I had a friend who had cancer who I knew was almost certainly going to die. And we went out to he invited me to cricket and we went to cricket. This is the last time I saw him. And he'd given, you know, he'd set up the comedy club where me and Stu met and set loads of people on the road to comedy and stuff. And yeah, you know, I really wish in hindsight I'd just said, you know, I didn't want to acknowledge that this might be the last time we met, because that would be to say you're not going to make it through this, which, I, you know, there was still a chance he would make it through. It was unlikely and he didn't. But equally, you know, I really regretted not just, you know, even as we said goodbye, not just making a little bit of it or just saying, look, I just want to thank you. I mean, you know, he knew I was grateful and I'd said things, but not directly to him. And that's sort of weird, the way, I mean, that's, you know, it's, and I was going to say, it's like, it's being a man, but I don't think it is just being a man. It's a human thing, isn't it?
I think it's a really human thing. And I think, you know, partly why I said that in the book is the things I regret not telling my dad. Like I sort of want to be like this time traveler from the past being like, look, I did it. I lived it and I regret it. Please don't do what I did. And even though I've, you know, forgiven myself for the things I didn't ask him, I think exactly like you said, it's easy to not say it. Like it's easier in the moment not to say it, but it's not easier in the long term. And it's trying to get people to sort of make that click in their heads of like, I know, saying to someone beforehand, like, look, I just need to know what you want for your funeral. Or I just need to know what, like, if something happens to you, like, where is everything? and I just want you to know that I'm going to miss you. Like all of the stuff is very difficult to say. But as you said, that regret of thinking, oh, I didn't just take the leap, jump off the high board and just do it because of what we're so afraid of it. And as I said, it's like this, it's almost a mad thing to be afraid of. This is a terrible metaphor, but it's like being afraid of like going to the loo. Like it's going to happen. It's happening to all of us. The more we just laugh about it, admit it, like this is what happens, then we can just breathe a bit and be like, oh yeah, we're all these weird animals and this is the thing that happened to us, you know, we live and we breathe and we die. And I understand and I get like evangelical about it, but it's just, as I said, I joined this club so early, I feel like I learned this lesson at 15 of like, oh fuck, people fucking die. Like you can't run from this, you can't hide from it, you can't educate yourself enough to protect yourself from it. Like you know, my dad was an extremely healthy person. Like, he was training for an Ironman. Like, he was like running triathlons and marathons. So even that, you know, the protection we give ourselves with health, I'm like, well, I'm healthy, I'll be okay. And it's like, not always. Like, so and people think, obviously that sounds quite morbid, but what I mean by that is like, don't waste these chances that we do get to say these things to people or have that conversation. And like, I'm sure your friend understood. And I always think when it comes to like death and grief, certain people don't say it and certain people do. So I'm sure he had people who did acknowledge it. Like you said, that conversation with the brother, like somebody says it and then you can open it up. And it doesn't always have to be, you know, you don't have to be always the one like I'm going to open this conversation, but it's about like, yeah, trying, or when it does, not shutting it down and being like, oh yeah. And I always say a lot to people, it's not a short-term thing. Like if you feel you fucked up once, or I didn't ask them, or I didn't really bring it up, you can fix it. Like even if it was two years ago, 10 years ago, you can say to someone, I'm so sorry, when that came up about your brother, I didn't say anything because I was absolutely panicking. And that's so shit. And I just want you to know, I'm aware it's shit. I'm sorry. Like, we sort of feel like if we don't get it right in the first 2 weeks, well, that's it, I'm out, I fucked up. So I'm never going to bring it up again. You're like, that's still not bringing it up.
Yeah, it is. I just remembered, actually, we did this with my friend who died. He just said to me at one point, if I do die, I'd like you to do, a speech. Would you like to do a speech at the funeral? I said, oh, I'd be delighted. and then we both really laughed at that. so that was all right. But then, there wasn't an acknowledgement. And I did fuck up, but it was in a funny way. And I think that's, you've got to own the fuck ups. And
yeah,
I think
everyone,
you know from the other side that it's, that people will fuck up if people are if people aren't being deliberately mean, if they're not then most human beings are going to respond with, look, I understand what you're trying to say, and I know you won't be delighted,
and that's the thing
that I'm dead I
try to say as well, to kind of get, because sometimes it can be like the club versus the people not in the club of like, oh, they don't understand, or they said something insensitive, and I'm trying to say all the time to, like, I get emails from people of like, look, they're not, it's not malicious when people, really, most of the time when people say something stupid, it's just fear. It's fear and having no practice. Like, we're all, even the pandemic, when you saw people again, you're like, oh God, I'm so out of practice of like chat. Like, how do I chat? What do I say? And it's the same with grief, like, because we don't have these conversations from an early age, and we don't see our parents having them, and we don't see our relatives talking about it, that we don't learn of like, oh, you should fucking bring it up, or you should ask questions, or you should, talk about it. So it is something that, of course, I think, except you're going to be bad at from the beginning. I definitely was. The only reason I can spout this off now is because I've been talking to people for 7 years about death beforehand. I definitely wasn't like as cool with asking about it. I'd be like, oh God, okay, I'll try. So, don't be afraid to be wrong, I think, is the big thing. If you want to help, if you feel like, look, I'm not the person to help, that's also absolutely fine.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
And and you admit in the book that you at the time you hadn't written a will. Have you written a will now?
I felt so bad about writing this chapter about wills and like not
being prepared.
It's that thing about writing, isn't it? I was like, I've got to write about preparing. Oh, I'm not prepared. And I thought, well, that's a good angle. I'm not prepared. I'll be honest. And then I thought, well, you're going to have to do it now. So yes, now I do have a will, although I haven't properly sorted it, completely finished all the bits, but I have done it. I think I need to do something else, they said. So I was like, oh God, isn't it enough? I filled out an online form. What more do you want from me? But yes, wills. And the big thing I have in that chapter, which I know is uncomfortable for lots of people to talk about, but bare minimum is a will. No, bare minimum is at least telling someone your laptop password. Like, just let them know. And then a will. And then you can have this thing called advanced care planning, which, you can just get off the internet, these templates. So if you have an accident or you're in a vegetative state, it, tells your loved ones what you would want to happen to you. And it's scary stuff. I totally know how I used to feel about it versus how I feel now. But it's just, I think, interesting. So many people don't know it's even an option that you can, like, you can nominate a legacy contact on your Facebook. So that if you die, somebody is in charge of sorting it all out and gets permission to shut down things, or doesn't, you know, can memorialize your account. And I just think there's a lot of stuff that we just don't realize we might need to deal with, or someone might, you know, we might need to deal with for someone else.
Sure. Yeah, it's, and look, like you say, there is, there, you know, there's some, there's funny stuff. There's a funny story.
I promise it's
about,
funny,
you know,
guys. It's funny. No, too.
It, you know, but it, well, it's. I mean, I love the audio, but because it was great to hear all the other voices.
Yeah, yeah.
But, it, but you know, you do. I think you probably. The humor of it does come across from the audiobook. There's a very funny the story about your dad's ashes, which is not a funny occasion.
It was funny.
People must have low. You know, there must be so many funny things that happen with ashes, because it is such both like the fact that where they were stored, and then what happened to them when they were.
Yeah, he was in the wardrobe for 10 years because we just didn't know what to do, and then my mum would never tell me until I went to go into the wardrobe. And I saw this bag and I was like, what's that? Mom, what's that? She's like, oh, that's your dad. And I was like, what? Like, oh, is he, should we? Well, yeah, probably. Like, oh, okay. And we did eventually spread his ashes in Wales. And yeah, true, you know, absolute comedy style, as we spread them, it went in my face and went in my eye. And my eye was like pouring with water. The worst bit was my mum and my brother looking at me like, oh, this is quite bad, isn't it? Like, is she going to, like, you know, that family look of like, is she going to kick off, or is she going to like be fine? Like, oh shit, you know what she's like. This could go either way. Yeah. And I did just laugh because I thought, I mean, how ridiculous that I've got my dad's ashes in my eye. It was really painful. My eye was pouring. And then it's like, you're trying to get it out and you're like, what am I doing? Like, is that rude? Is it rude to do that? I don't know. What was it? Yeah, so that was, I mean, it felt right though. It's quite a nice, and because we'd waited so long to spread his ashes, we were all quite, you know, built up and nervous and like, oh God, like we're finally doing it and trying to have this meaningful ceremony. And then when that happened, I think it did relieve a lot of tension. It was like, oh, well, we're not very sort of, I don't know, we're not a family where poetic things happen. It's sort of always something stupid happens, you know. But
yeah,
from the podcast, I've had so many stories like that where just you just can't believe like what is happening in the face of this momentous, dignified situation, you know, where someone is dying, the breath is leaving their body. And I can't remember who told it to me, but somebody said there was a cleaner in the hospital and she kept switching off the Hoover and going, I'll wait, just let me know. And they were like waiting for their mum to die. And they were like, oh, right, okay. But she was saying it like they should be grateful. So they were like, oh, thank you. She was like, I'll come back in a minute when she's gone. And they were like, why? We'd be great. We didn't have to deal with this right now, you know. I just love
it. It's sort of worse afterwards as well.
Oh, she's gone.
Now she's dead.
She's gone. You can start. Yeah. Just around the edges. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, do the sides.
Yeah. But that's pure, you know, but funerals.
Oh God,
and that situation, it is so solemn that that's where comedy comes from, isn't it? When things are so serious and it's everything that a joke has. It's people being not laughing. It's tension.
It's something
you have to take very seriously. So then whenever anything goes a little bit wrong,
it's too glorious, isn't it?
It's too glorious, but also it should, you know, there should be laughter at funerals and there should be happiness really as well in memory. It's obviously harder in certain circumstances.
I get asked that a lot by interviewers who are not comedians, who say, oh, humor and grief, you know, why? And you're just like you said, I also think we forget how absurd death is. Like the fact that someone can be there and then not be there, it's mad. It's absolutely mad. It is the punchline of a joke. It makes no sense that someone you love and care for is breathing and talking to you and then they can not be. And so I think there's a lot of times where the laughter is like, you said, it's that tension of like, what the fuck? So you kind of laugh. And I think that's why I love interviewing comedians about their grief, because the way they see it and process it, it is always to see the absurdness of it and how all of this makes no sense. All of this, you know, all of the, everything we're doing makes no sense. And I really love their take on it. And I always find those episodes, obviously I love talking to all my guests, but the comedians ones where I've like laughed my head off whilst hearing this terrible, terrible story just makes you go, God, yeah, that's life, isn't it? It's both of those things. And Yeah, it's not always possible. I mean, my other theory is that when you laugh, you like take in more oxygen, like you physically have to breathe harder. And yeah. I do think there's something in that when something, especially in hospitals where like someone's very sick and ill and you feel a bit like you're dying, it feels like you've sort of caught it and, you know, you're dealing with medicine and curtains pulled and you're kind of all in that brain. And then when you laugh, it's like your body's reminding you, you're still fucking here. You're still alive. And it's quite a nice sort of moment where you're like, oh yeah, I'm okay. And I think you feel that's the, where the guilt comes in slightly of like, oh, I can laugh, I'm free, I can breathe. Oh God, they can't. But I think we need to get a bit kinder to ourselves and being like, yeah, they can't, they're dying. That's what happens. It's all right for you to still be here. Remind yourself, my feet are still on the ground. I'm still breathing. I'm still okay. And I will live through this. But it's quite a nuanced, overwhelming sense of emotions when you are obviously at the same time, heartbreaking for somebody who's dying that you love.
Of course. I mean, there's loads of interesting stuff in this book, and we haven't got time to talk about all of it, and I don't want to blow it all because I want people to enjoy it and read it for themselves. But I found it very interesting to you talking about your dad when you in that analog and digital
thing
that's happened, that people who died before
the internet
this century really are not anywhere online. It's sort of I've realized it when I've looked up old teachers and stuff like that. Yeah. And there's nothing about them at all on the internet. It's absolutely, it's sort of so bizarre to think that you know, 20 years or whatever is.
Oh, it's mad, isn't it? Yeah. Isn't it?
But it's such a fascinating thing to think about. And then what digital footprint we all have now. I mean, that's the thing I thought about myself is if I ever do die, there's so much stuff for my kids. If they don't know who I am, there's so much stuff for them to find out who I was. If the internet's still there, I mean, there's way too much. I don't think they could ever catch up.
Overwhelming amount of like...
I wouldn't want them to. But yeah, you know, there's no... As long as the internet's still there, there's no danger of me being like entirely gone.
Yeah.
You know, but it is sort of fascinating that someone who died seemingly so recently is you know, you can't you Google him and there's nothing no results.
I know, and I didn't obviously, as I say, it didn't occur to me until I started doing the Griefcast. And I remember the first time doing an interview with someone and they were describing their dad or something and they said, oh, well, let me show you a picture. And I thought, oh, how would you do that? Like, what do you mean, picture of your dad? And they just got their phone and just flipped it because it was on their lock screen. And I was like, what? How is it on your lock screen? I mean, obviously I could digitize a picture, but it was just the readiness and the ease, you know, that people have.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm an analog griever because he died in 1998, but everyone sort of post 2000 is digital grievers because they tend to have digital photos, voice notes, emails, social media profiles, you know, this array of memories. And I was so jealous. I was so jealous at first. I was like, I can't believe it. I've got nothing. I've got some like tawdry objects he bought me, and then they're not tawdry, sorry, they're very nice, I do like them. And then I sort of realized they were still grieving, like it didn't matter, even though they had all this stuff, it didn't make their process any easier. And so I realized, you know, it must be like, I don't know, the birth of photography, the birth of film, you know, there'd be people from the century before, the 19th century, being like, you've got a photo, I've only got a painting and one memory of my father, like, so you know, the way we capture things, the way we obsessively capture things, I think is really interesting. And it's interesting because I do think there's a feeling behind it of trying to stop death and stop being forgotten. And as you said, it still relies on the internet existing in the way that, you know, we have a video of a VHS of him, but we don't have a VHS player. So, you know, we did get it digitized, but then we needed a DVD player and then maxed up adding them to the drives, guys. So now we don't watch it. Like, it's all this idea that you can contain someone. And I think I found it really, really interesting that I think we're all going to have to start thinking about it a lot more. As you said, like what you leave, there's actually a lot more stuff. I mean, before you might've gone into someone's house and been like, fucking hell, look at their record collection. Jesus Christ, what are you going to do with it? And now you're like, fucking hell, look at all these drives. Richard's gone. How many drives? What series is this? Like, what one is this? Like, this is the book one, but what, like, again, it's the digital stuff. We think we've decreased it, but we just put it somewhere else. Just put it in an invisible cupboard as opposed to a literal cupboard.
Yeah. And you know, I think, you know, the idea of remembering someone is, you know, it's important for you and it's important, but eventually, you know, however long it is, the memory's only as long, lives as long as people who are interested. When my grandma lived to like 102,
wow,
and had Alzheimer's disease, so she forgot all of us. We'd go and say she didn't know who we were, oh. But I really loved it because the only person she would remember from her whole life was her dad, who died like before I was born, I think. But like, I just loved the idea, and she just loved her dad. She, oh yeah, I'm Ernest, I love my dad. Yeah, but she didn't know her own daughter. She didn't know any of us. But I loved the idea for him. He, you know, he was decades dead, obviously, yeah, by that stage. But I loved the fact that this woman, that he was her last memory, and that his memory, you know, carried on to that point.
That's
obviously,
so nice.
My mum still remembers him, but you know, but yeah. It's a lovely thing, you know, out of the horribleness of a woman forgetting everybody, her remembering her dad and still loving her dad and going, you remember your dad? Of course I remember my dad, not remembering anyone else. So, but I think that would be that's a lovely little memento of when there's that cartoon of the Day of the Dead cartoon, which the name I've forgotten, if you must have seen it, but you know, it's an animated film. It's called
Coco.
Coco, yeah.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
And that really, it's, well, A, because we were trying to get my grandma to remember her favourite music, which she didn't, everyone was singing it to her. So whenever I see Coco, I'm in floods of tears, because there's this old woman who just finally remembers that her dad.
Oh,
just
God.
At the end of her life. But my grandma never forgot him. So, you know, those are the things that matter. You know, it's not, you know, like you say, stuff is nice and but you can you only need a few things to remember someone by.
Yeah, and I think that's what I really realized, like, you know, I have a few things, but actually it's more than enough for somebody who died 20 years ago. And, you know, it doesn't mean when I come across something new or you know, I get sent something, you're still like, oh wow, God, that's amazing, like, how lovely. You know, if I see pictures of him as a child I haven't seen before, you're like, oh wow, yeah. God, wow. But yeah, you know, it doesn't stop the grief having thousands of emails. That's the thing I realized. I was like, oh, they've got all these communications. And it's like, yeah, it's still just like, oh, yeah, I'll speak to you later. Love you, Dad, kiss. Like, it doesn't bring a person back. And
no.
I think, it's just a new world that we're definitely having to negotiate, which we've never had to. So I do think it's interesting to sort of note what's going to happen in the future. And I mentioned it in the book as well, like that thing with Kim and Kanye, like when he made a hologram of her dad. And I remember that the day that happened, you know, there was obviously lots of talk about it and everyone was like, wow. And my Griefcast Twitter is very active and lots of people use it to help each other and talk to each other. And all of us were like, oh my God, no. Like, I know. What? He definitely isn't in the club. How can you be in the club and think that a hologram, actually, I think he is. I think he lost his mum, didn't he? But it's just like, if someone had made a hologram, my dad, I would be so freaked out. I'd be like, this is so weird. So, you know, each to their own. And luckily, none of us have the funds to make that happen. So.
No, that's true. But maybe in the future, we'll all just have a little,
yeah.
We'll have a little robot of all of our relatives, God, sitting in the corner, who have their personality and everything.
Moaning about the telly and what you're doing.
And you go, why the fuck won't you fuck off? And I bet, you know, grief and love are two sides of the same coin. And the reason, if we didn't have death and if we didn't have grief, we probably wouldn't have love at all. You know, I mean, I think the danger of that peril of losing someone is what makes everyone so precious. If none of us died, you know, I'm not convinced we would feel as precious as we do about each other, because, you know, it is that jeopardy, and that we know at some point one side of that equation is going to go and then eventually both of them. So it's, you know, it's a fascinating subject, and it's, you know, and I think, as I've said, it's just, and with so many of the things in this book club, but in comedy as well, just, it's amazing how, you know, I think it's comedians we forget as well, but just how little people talk about a lot of these things and how things can really be problematic. I mean, smaller things than death generally, but that, if you just talk about, then they are almost instantly sorted out. But I think with death, talking about can just, you know, can help. And what I love about this book is it's not, and now I'm all better.
I mean, I'm definitely still in therapy,
guys. I
don't
mind anyone. Yeah. So, yeah, you know, because it's never going to be that. So it's that honesty of, you know, you say it's not going to be horrible as for all the time forever, but it's also now it's not going to be, you're not going to reach a point of not caring about it.
Yeah, and I think that's the thing of like, well, I remember when I first finally went to therapy, and she kind of like, remember how asked me like kind of why, what I wanted, and we sort of got to it that I kind of wanted to have no grief. I was like, I want this to be sort of done, you know, this crying about everything and being so stressed and having all this anxiety. And she was like, well, I think what we're looking for is like a normal level of like, you know, these feelings. I was like, what? Because I thought, oh, it never occurred to me. My whole search from teenagers was like, right, how can we get rid of it? How can we fix it? So it's done. It fucks off. And I finished, level over. And I was just like, oh, I see. I'm going to have to deal with this shit forever. Oh, okay. And I do think, although that was obviously painful and disappointing to find out, oh, that's not what I hoped humanity would look like. It was also easier. So I was like, oh, I see. So I'm going to carry it with me forever. Some days it's heavy, some days it's light, but I don't have to sort of stress about it or worry or feel guilty that I haven't done it right or it's still here or like it needs attending, you know, like it's a crack in the wall. Like I must fix that. And it's a crack in the wall. Your house is fine. It's just always going to be there. Like it's just one of those things. And yeah, that just made it me like this weight lifted off me. I was like, okay, great. So I don't have to spend this time trying to run away from something that you can't. And it, you know, I've said before, like it would be weird to have no grief. You have no emotion to it, to be like, oh yeah, my dad died, absolutely neutral about it, couldn't care less. Like that would be odd. But that is often what people want to say when they're like, oh, you're over it. They're looking for you to say, yes, I am never sad about this thing. Whereas, like you said, that's why we love each other. That's why we're connected. And, you know, I'm not a fan of the phrase grief is the price you pay for love, because I've met so many people who didn't love those people and yet still grieve them. So I will caveat that just to say, like, you know, you can still grieve someone that you didn't love. It can still be painful. Yeah. But I do think, like you said, what you said there was really interesting. Like, that's what makes this process interesting, this life interesting, because it's finite and you can't capture it and you can't, you know, freeze it forever in the way that we think we can with the way we live our lives digitally. So yeah, I don't know. I've run out of a point, but there you go. By the way,
no, it was, yeah, I don't think you have. I think it's great. There's loads of other stuff. We won't talk about it, but I love the stuff about understanding the five stages of grief. It's about
bullshit.
Well, it's not for the griever. It's for the person, you know, it's for the person. And I sort of, when I found out I had cancer, I basically did the cartoon, the comedy film Five Stages of Grief in about 10 seconds, literally just went, oh, well, and then I kind of accepted, went, okay, fine, well, let's work out exactly. Let's make sure Katie knows how to do the dishwasher was basically my end point. Before I go, my skills must be passed on. So yeah, it's interesting to see this from the other side, and just, you know, and I would just, you know, and you're a parent as well, so you know, you don't, the idea that you could, that your kids are going to be unhappy about your death is so horrible, but equally there's, you know, there's nothing you can do about
no
it.
And also, like,
it's going to happen.
I did a funny gig where like we all stood up and it was like moments in your life, kind of odd gig. And this guy stood up and he was very nice. And he stood up and told this story about how he'd nearly died. And, it, you know, it was a very hopeful, beautiful story. And it made him realize how much he loved his children. And he said, which obviously just for me, he stood on stage and he was like, and I thought, you know, what would her life be like if I hadn't seen her finish school, go to university, get married? You know, what would it be like? And I was sat there thinking, well, it'd be my life and she'd be fine. I text my friend, who's my like school friend, who her dad passed away when she was 8, and she's like my, you know, go-to gang girl, grief girl. And I was like, can you fucking believe this man said that? She was like, oh God, they always think that we're in pieces without them. And I was like, yeah, you know, and obviously I have been, and obviously I'm sad, but it's this idea that it's destroying. It destroys people. Yeah. And, you know, obviously some people obviously are destroyed by it, but also this as well, where you do live with it and you're all right-ish. That's all right. That's not a bad thing to aim for. So yeah, you can't control it, but you can sort of, I think, try and find a peace with it in your life. And the only way to do that is to be like, oh yeah, okay, it's going to happen. So maybe I can do some practical things, like make sure people know how to use the dishwasher. That, I think that's amazing. Like, honestly, that's the kind of shit you need. Where is the folder with all the things in? How do you do the dishwasher? You know, where do you keep the fabric softener? Like all this stuff, you know, that the other one doesn't know. Sit down and go through it with them.
It's true. And look, it's true that that a podcast has become a book. It's happened to a few podcasts. Was the process of getting this book published, was it something you took to a publisher, or did a publisher come to you?
I'd had people asking for a bit of like, oh, you know, what do you think about a book, and is it something? And to be honest, it took me ages to get my head around how this conversations that I was having would become a book. And then it wasn't, I suppose, until I'd been doing it probably about, I guess it was about 4 years, and I thought, oh, actually, well, what happened was the same things kept coming up. So people kept talking and I'd be like, oh, episode 97, you need to listen to that. Oh, that's 13, listen to that. And I was like, oh, I've got all this bloody, you must have this, I've got this Wikipedia of my own show in my head. And I was like, oh, I wish there was a place I could put all this stuff that we've all agreed on. And I was like, oh, well, then that would be a book. Whereas I think when they first started asking, I was like, oh, I don't know how I would do that. And so I wrote a proposal, and then I took it to a book agent who then took it to the publishers. So I kind of, I did know that people, you know, weren't definitely like, oh, get out of here, we don't want a book about death. But I guess it took me long enough to kind of learn the lessons. And then I thought, right, this is worth telling people this stuff that I know.
Yeah. And I really like, you know, I like that comedians or comedy people end up writing these quite serious books about quite
so
big
mad,
subjects.
Isn't it? And about huge. Someone has spent the rest of their life researching and eyeballing. We're like, well, I've talked to people for 7 years. I think I know. Yeah. I think I know what it's
there. There's loads of, because it's human and you're a communicator. And but like you say, you draw on all this stuff. I noticed, and this is just a very technical point about the audiobook that I'm interested in. I noticed that some of the excerpts from the podcast were from the podcast,
yes,
and some of them you read out yourself. Was that why did some of the excerpts not?
Oh,
come
do you know what?
Podcast?
I didn't even know that. I didn't even know that.
Maybe it's just because it wasn't a direct quote.
Oh,
or something,
yeah, no. Sometimes we'd had to. That was it. So if we could take it from the podcast, we did, because obviously it's more interesting. But sometimes it was like their quote had been truncated from like 15 minutes, and you were trying to. Yeah. Get 2 points in to make a point. So if it was like the edit would have sounded insane, I think they just stuck with me reading it. But
that's a shame. I hoped it would be people going, I don't want to be in your fucking I do your podcast, but I'm not being in your book.
In your bloody book. No, you've had enough of me. Bloodsucker. Yeah, no,
it's great to have all those voices and all those, but it's not overwhelmed by that either. It's not just, you know, that you could do a book which is, here's a load of transcripts of my podcast.
Yeah, and that's what I didn't want to do. Yeah.
No, it's very sparing. It's great. It's really properly, here's the bit of evidence, and it really, really works, I think, especially as an audiobook. I think.
Oh, good. Thank you. As I said, and now it is, the correct files have been uploaded. So look forward to me actually speaking in a normal voice. That'll be exciting.
Well, it's a big recommend. I hope you will all buy it. You are not alone. By Carrie Lloyd, of course. I ask people if they're reading anything at the moment that they would like to recommend, or have read anything recently you'd like to recommend.
I yesterday finished Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow by Gabrielle Zevin, which you'll have seen the cover everywhere. It's like the metallic-y kind of Hokkaido wave. It's brilliant. It's so, so good. It's about two gamers in the 90s that start designing games and just their relationship. And I'm not a gamer, and you do not have to understand that world at all. It's just a really well-written, brilliant tale that is undoubtedly going to get made into television. So watch it before someone ruins your version of it.
Okay, terrific. That's a great recommendation. Look, Gary, thanks so much for giving us your time. Good luck with the podcast and the book, of course. Thanks very much to Chris Evans, not that one, for his fantastic production skills. And Ben Evans, not that one, who does so much work for the podcast. And Chris believes is his son, though he isn't.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Thanks very much for listening to the podcast. Go to GoFasterStripe.com for fantastic downloads and books, and to join the Go Faster Stripe Club and get loads of stuff from really interesting comedians. Help little Chris Evans knock that one out. That would be lovely. All right, RichardHerring.com for all my gigs. Hope to see you at a gig. Come and say hi after if you've enjoyed these podcasts. Don't come if you haven't enjoyed them and say you haven't enjoyed them. It'll make me feel sad.